Today is March 18th. Unbelievable. 2021. This is episode number 544 of the Apple Context Machine. That's a podcast for the Mac Observer. That's our guest's sound effects. I'm Brian Chaffin, Head Mango. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, you can shoot me a note at macobserver.com/contextmachine, which will take you to our Facebook group. Now, joining me today from his fortress of vitriol is John Keat.
The secret is I'm safe on the inside and you're all affected on the outside. And to get right into the vitriol, why on earth would the mute button on this app actually be audible? The whole point of it is to mute. That was me hitting mute and unmute
on
Discord. It's crazy.
That's
who does that?
That is
it's lunatic programming.
I think there may be a setting for that now that you mention it, because
I just like, you know what? In some ways it's the most insidious. It's like some kind of, you know, there's some kind of anger that the programmer has that is coming out like just very, very subtly. It's very much kind of like the red stapler guy, you know, it's just he hates everything. He can't quite express it. And the way to really manifest it is to, I know what I'll do. I'll make the mute button make the most obnoxious noise that everyone hears. Perfect. Genius. Like evil genius. I love it.
It is evil genius. Not speaking of evil genius, we have two sponsors for the show, LinkedIn Jobs and Molecule. I'm going to tell you about both of them later in the show. But first of all, John, you wrote a column for us this week about bit flipping. Is this something to do with this cryptocurrency stuff?
Not really at all. Although I guess it could affect that too. There you are.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, this is something I remember was kind of a fun theoretical exercise back when I was studying computer science in the long, long ago, very long time ago. And I remember back then the error rate. So your computer has memory, RAM, and RAM, you know, it's works on electricity, obviously, inside the computer. And little cells inside the memory have a voltage in there, you know, 5 volts or 0 volts. It varies based on the computer device, but roughly it's like that, where one voltage expresses a one, another voltage expresses a zero. And they're generally not subject to a lot of interference in there. And of course, a long time ago, the circuits were so big and wide and fat in computers, you know, in early computers. They were, right now, Apple has computer chips out that are in an impossibly small 5 nanometers. It's kind of insane that 5 nanometers is 10 atoms of width for the computer circuit.
It's just crazy. It's just crazy. And they work. They actually function.
Yeah, it's a genuine marvel of the modern world that works. Back in the long ago days, you know, these traces were much fatter. They were 320 nanometer, 500 nanometer, and bigger. And interestingly, in space, for those taking a ride up in a SpaceX ship or in a rocket ship up to the space station that goes around the Earth, the devices are hardened because there's so much radiation out in space. And so those devices are limited in size, generally around 150-ish nanometers. They don't want it any smaller, because when the traces get that small, you can get cosmic rays, neutrons that pass through the device and actually flip the state of the voltage from a one to a zero.
Before we get deeper into that, I'm guessing this is why the Mars rover that just landed is using essentially the equivalent of the original G3 processor. That's part of it.
Right. So if you have to make the traces much fatter, right? So to put that in context, a hardened device will use traces that are 30 times wider than what Apple is using in the current tech. And And when you apply that to surface area, that's squared, right? So now you have so much less space to do a modern design inside of a physically limited size chip that you can produce, because it's hardened that way. And yeah, it's you know, I'm assuming that the Mars rover uses kind of standard. It's different when you're on a planet, for example. You don't need it to be quite as hardened. So maybe they have a 100.
It's different when you're on a planet that has a functioning magnetosphere.
A thick atmosphere, and importantly, a magnetosphere.
Yeah.
So that's way weaker on Mars. I'm not a Mars expert, so I'm assuming it's way weaker there. It's a smaller planet, plus it has less atmosphere, and I don't know if it has a kind of a molten core that's tumbling about. But anyway, so inherently it limits the sophistication of the devices you can take in space, because there's so much cosmic rays. The odds of it flipping bits basically becomes a certainty that they will. And at a certain point, it's just too fine a machine to work reliably there.
Okay. So let's go back to the actual issue that's happening here on this planet.
So on this planet, back when I started, the traces were so large that the odds of a bit being flipped were really astronomically small. Like, you might have a bit flipped back when you had 8, you know, megabytes of memory, not 8 gigabytes of memory. It might flip, you know, once a year, once every 10 years. It was really very rare. But as the traces, the circuit traces have gotten so small, and the size of memory has gotten very huge, the odds of this increase. And there was an article I was reading about, and it's an interesting article on a somewhat, it's a tangential topic about typo squatting. But what it noted is that when 4 gigabytes machine were the norm, and that was a while ago already, right? Because like, even a low-end Mac now comes with 8 gigabytes. But when 4 gigabytes of memory was kind of the norm, there was a 96% chance of having a random bit flip every 3 days.
Well, so why do I even care about a random bit flip?
So just to do the math there, that means on average, you're probably having a bit flip every day, right? Roughly at this point today. And why do you care? So, you know, odds are when it flips a bit, it might be nothing. It might change, you know, if you have a photo open in memory, right? It might change the hue or color of one pixel in an image that you won't even notice, right? It might just hit kind of inert data, but it also could hit the CPU and give you a random bomb. The machine will just hard crash for no good reason, because you don't know where it's going to hit. And there's an example in the article I noted that there was someone that was a speed runner. You know, these guys play video games and they try to get through Mario 64 in the fastest time possible. And it always takes a certain amount of time. And this one runner got lucky because, you know, apparently there was a random bit flip, and the monster, instead of being at face level where you have to fight them, was floating so high up that he didn't have to fight him. And he was freaking out. I was like, oh my gosh, I finished this super fast.
Oh, wow.
Because the monster wasn't even where it was supposed to be. So it can manifest itself in all kinds of weird ways. But the insidious and worst way, which this article didn't get into, is what you call kind of data corruption rot, where you have a bit flipped, you save the document with this corruption, and then over time, because it, right now, roughly once a day, you're having a bit flipped, you are having data corrupted. And when you operate on corrupted data and manipulate it more, that corrupts things even more. And so the question is, since this has become kind of common now, where once a day you're having a bit flipped, you know, what can be done about it, and why isn't something being done about it? Back when it, you know, this happened once every 5 years, who cares, right? Like, it's so crazy and frequent, but now it's not at that level anymore. Over the, like, you know, as computing has progressed into these impossibly small, 5 nanometers. And I think next year is going to be 3 nanometers, 6 atoms wide, right? Traces and whatnot, that it's become a bigger problem. And, why haven't the computer makers addressed it? One easy way to address this is with something, well, in outer space, they harden it and do these things, but we don't have to do that on Earth. That we have something called ECC memory, parity memory, error correcting memory, basically. And what happens is, if a random bit gets changed, this memory can automatically detect that it was changed and fix the error. And higher end computers like the Mac Pro use ECC memory. My Mac Pro, the 2019 Mac Pro, has it. And actually all Mac Pros had came with ECC memory. And so, you know, why not just make that standard? Since the error rate has gone up so tremendously, why not make ECC memory standard so that this kind of bit flipping won't occur? And there's some, you know, serious one I told about the data corruption, but the original source of the article was hackers using this bit flipping to basically, you know, hack information and sites. So I don't know if you've heard of typo squatting, but that's when, you know, a common misspelling for Apple might, instead of be APPL, it might be AAPL, right? Like just you people type.
URL typo squatting. So yeah. domain typo squatting.
Right. Domain typo squatting. Yeah. And so people buy these misspellings, right, of these websites, and then hold the, you know, Apple hostage and say you might, because so much traffic is coming there and they're getting requests and they're getting people's private data sometimes that they can misuse. So people squat on these things to either monetize them, to redirect them, you know, like someone could buy AAPL and redirect it to, you know, Intel or something like that. And some people think that's okay. Some people think that's unfair. But what's happening is, since there's so many bits being flipped, some of these bit flips are causing the kind of the equivalent or analog to these typo squatting misspellings. And hackers are taking advantage of that because they see the rates have gone up so high that they're using it to get these domains, to get information that should be directed to a legitimate site. And some of these are very, you know, they're encrypted, quieting, they're sensitive data that's otherwise being requested where it shouldn't be. You so very real world effects of this.
You don't mean that they're target, like they're no one is targeting me with a typo squat, but instead they're basically throwing out this huge net that is so wide that when it catches any small number of people, that those people add up.
Let me give you a for instance. Yes, it does add up, but we know that Apple has a request for, say, a security software update, right? There's a server that macOS pings that says, you know, give me a security update. If I was a devious hacker, right, what I would do is I'd say, what is the likely bit flip domain name of this? And let's say I get five different, you know, let's say the URL is security.com, right? It's not that, obviously, but let's say it's that. So maybe the bit flip of that is security.com, right? So I buy that domain and I look for requests for security updates. And then I could use that to try to launch an attack on someone's machine, right? That's requesting a security update, because there may be all kinds of encrypted key information that's being passed between my machine and Apple server that we expect some level of privacy on. But now that's being sent to the wrong place because there was a bit flip.
Okay. But again, individuals aren't being targeted. They're just hoping that you randomly stumble there. And well, it's happening enough that they're getting large numbers of victims.
There could be large numbers of victims, but let's say you're really, you know, you're paid by a large entity, a government or something like that, to do no good. And you know that Al Gore has a Mac, right? And his Mac probably gets security updates. And so you might get, you know, 1,000 a day of these bit flip errors being sent to your kind of hacker version of the security site. And you're just waiting for Al Gore's identifier to come through. And once it does, bad things can happen. So who knows what it's being used for? The bottom right. line is it's happening so frequently that hackers are taking advantage of it. And again, that's not necessarily even the biggest problem. I think one of the biggest problems over time is going to be this kind of data rot that's occurring, that you don't even know that you're mashing up and destroying data because it's just little by little, once a day, being compounded. But yeah, there are many ramifications to it, and there's a solution to it. And I get why in the early days, you know, the computer maker says, why are we adding expense by adding, basically you need to add an extra chip to the memory to do this parity checking, to fix bit flips. But yeah, you know, when it was a rare occurrence, it made sense. But now it's such a common occurrence. At what point kind of does it become negligent for computer device makers to ignore this and not just add ECC memory to everything? Because yes, yeah, it's a little more expensive now, but if everyone starts using ECC memory, it's going to come down in price to very near what regular memory is really quickly. So, you know, in my opinion, I was shocked at the how high the rate it was, because I was still operating with my, you know, before time notions of these errors were super rare. But when it's happening roughly once a day, yeah, that's kind of crazy. I'm glad I have my Mac Pro. You know, it's one of the only machines that you know where you can get this. But my laptop is basically a data corrupting sieve at this point.
Is it a situation where the more memory you have, the more likely it is?
I don't think it's density certainly has an effect, because the finer the traces, right, the more susceptible they are to, and it's not just, you know, neutron and cosmic rays. There are other types of interferences that can do this. And I'm not, you know, an interference engineer where I can go down into the depths there, but those are, you know, the neutrons and cosmic rays are not the only source, but yeah, the finer, the lithography on the chips, the more easily susceptible they are to this kind of thing. And the surface area, the larger the surface area. So if you literally have more sticks of memory, right, like there's more targets to be hit, that helps. But so it's a combination of the two, but it's not merely just like capacity, right? It's not the capacity. It's kind of how fine are the circuits, and then how much surface area of those circuits is there a target to hit?
Yeah, I agreed.
And so what do you think? Should people start, like, should the manufacturers start moving over, if, you know, with these error rates?
Obviously. Or? I mean, this is crazy. This situation is completely, I mean, it is unfathomable that it could be happening as much as once a day. Now, it's not like you're going to, okay, every time it happens, it's very unlikely that you're going to have something serious affected, but it's right. A chance every time that something right. serious could be affected.
Like, for instance, my RAM right now, more than half of it is free memory. Like, so if it, you know, flips a bit in free memory, who cares, right? And then a huge part of my memory is cache, which some of it may be ready to be purged, in which case who cares, although some of it may be acted upon in the near future, in which case I care a lot. So, and then there's the actual active part of the memory too. So yeah, even at once a day, you know, a lot of the times, and we're just talking about memory, of course it could hit the CPU too. And it's very likely if it hits the CPU, you're going to get a hard lock, because everything in the CPU is kind of critically, you know, dominoed on one another. But, anyway, the bottom line is, yeah, at a certain point, this rate really is going to become nuts. And why not deal with it, you know, before it starts to really mash a lot of data for people? Because we're aggregating this across billions of users too, right? So, yeah. And let me put it this way. If it's become an issue for someone doing a Mario speedrun, and if hackers are actively taking advantage of it, now may be the time to actually have an industry move to this. I don't know why. No one else is, you know, kind of, and I thought it was just weird, like that it really buried the lead with that story. I mean, yeah, it's interesting that hackers are doing this, but the real lead is holy mackerel. There's a 96% chance that in a mere 4 gigs of memory, your bits are flipped, Every three days. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, I'm guessing that no one's going to bother with this unless it starts getting some mainstream attention.
Because
you're not only talking the expense of the components, but you're also there are development costs, there are design costs, there's operations cost in making a switch like that. There are all kinds of additional cost than merely the cost of the component.
Yeah, so, I mean, so a lot of industry would have to, Yeah, a lot of industry would have to retool. It's kind of a, it's always a catch 22 on supply meeting demand, demand finding supply. But the good news is it's a solved problem. It's not like, I mean, the Mac Pros had ECC memory for forever. My next computer had ECC memory. You know, it's been out for forever. It's a relatively cheap fix. So it's doable. It's just, there needs to be, I think you're right, people have to be made aware of it. The tech industry would actually have to do its job and report on it. Some company would have to say, you know what, it's the right thing to do this.
Right, for sure. Well, hopefully, you know, now that you pointed it out, I'm certainly hoping for some relatively fast action. Wouldn't surprise me if Apple actually led the way on this. But you never know. Could be someone else. All right, we have a fairly packed show today. So let me tell you about LinkedIn Jobs. We all know the LinkedIn service, the LinkedIn community. There's 722 million members worldwide. And with LinkedIn Jobs, you can tap into that community to help find the best candidate for your position. And the best thing, the thing I like about it most, is that you can manage all of your job posts and your contact candidates from a single view, and it's all within that familiar LinkedIn interface. All the functions are streamlined. You get everything on one simple screen. It's really easy to do. It's really easy to use, and it's really easy to organize hiring. And hiring right now, especially in the age of COVID, can be tricky. So what LinkedIn Jobs will do is make sure that they're putting the best candidates for your job position in front of you so that you can make the right choice. It's a good service. It's a good way to find people, and I strongly recommend it. So when your business is ready to make that next hire, find the right person with LinkedIn Jobs. Now you can post a job for free. All you have to do is visit linkedin.com/ACM. Again, that's linkedin.com/ACM to post a job for free. Terms and conditions apply, as they always do. And I very much appreciate them sponsoring this week's episode of ACM. Okay, John, we haven't talked about Oak Island in a long time. Actually, you and I have chatted a very, very little bit, but we haven't talked about it on a show. And it turns out that both of us are still interested.
Yes. By the way, spoiler alert, everything we talk about will be a spoiler. So skip ahead if you don't care about Oak Island or don't want to hear spoilers about Oak Island.
And now that you've put it that way, let me note that we're talking about the TV show, The Curse of Oak Island, which is on the History Channel. And it's season 8. If you have not watched the show, but you're interested in it, honestly, start halfway through season 6.
And I wouldn't even bother.
Well, man, that's Smith's Cove. That's underneath Smith's Cove. That stuff's crazy. They haven't been back to that, but it's crazy.
There's only 6 minutes of new information every hour show. The rest of it is beyond the commercials. Is a literal rehash of segments we've seen 1,000 times in a row.
They're finding so much stuff nowadays that's no longer true. A good half of the show is new stuff.
Yeah, you know, there's only so much excitement you can have people finding wood.
Well, fair enough. Or
there are better jokes in there, shoes. And I'm going to leave them. I'm going to leave it.
Leave them under the Smith's Cove. You know what would be fantastic? And I don't have the time by a lot to do this myself, but it'd be great if someone actually put together an episode list of, you know, here's the 2 episodes you need to watch from season 1.
Right,
and
right.
And 1 episode you need to watch of season 2. And a guide like that so that people who are new to the show could just, you know, catch up. To John's point, really, you could just probably start watching one of the recent episodes and, you know, you'd be caught up.
And the short synopsis is, they believe there's some kind of awesome treasure like the Holy Grail or the Lost Ark of the Covenant or who knows what else buried on this island. There have been treasure hunters looking for it at it for hundreds of years. And a couple of hundred years ago, they found this weird like stone tablet and weird shaft into the earth on this island. And people have been losing their minds trying to find the Holy Grail and whatnot on this island for hundreds of years and have yet to find anything. And spoiler, still have found nothing.
Still have found nothing. They found random things on the island, but that's because people live there.
And speeding up, like now it is clear that they have found some stuff that is so out of place time-wise and energy-wise. They found this cobble road that was buried underneath a swamp. And it's clear this cobble road took a lot of human energy.
Yeah, it's like three layers of cobble. When we're talking about cobble, we're talking about like relatively large stone cobbles.
And it's hundreds of feet long and maybe getting longer by the minute as they uncover more of it. And so you're looking at this and like, you know, why would you build a road to just bury a treasure, right? Like you could just haul the treasure in a hole little by little. Why do you have to go to the energy to build a freaking road? Like, what is it that you're moving that's so heavy that needs the support of a road?
Yeah. And then why do you then bury that road underneath a swamp?
Well, the swamp part could have been natural, you know, swampiness coming in. Well, it's natural to the extent that once you generate a swamp, which is also man-made, by the way, is the supposition going on, that will naturally get covered. But the road went up off of the swamp up into the hills, and it's covered there too, which is really suspicious. Like, why is that being hidden? It's a good point. Natural, you know, there wasn't a dirt fall of 5 feet to naturally cover that over time. I think someone purposefully buried it.
Yeah. And why? And why was it built? And it's crazy. And they found so far this year, they found like all kinds of physical evidence of that oxen teams were used on this road. They found, you know, ox shoes, nails. I'm sorry, ox shoe nails and various bits of harness and tackle that can be used with an oxen team. It's kind of crazy.
So I have a sunny side theory and a unfortunately realist theory.
Okay.
And so it dovetails on your point that, you know, they found these ox. Not horseshoes, but ox shoes, right, for the ox. And nails and that's, and I thought they found parts of the shoes as well.
Well, they might have. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. So there's a couple of hundred miles away, there's a fort that's established by the French. And it's kind of a living museum at this point, and they have all kinds of things in there. And the guys from Oak Island showed some of the ox shoes that they found along this cobble road, and the one of the people that helped run the French fort said, you know, these ox shoes are highly similar to the ox shoes that we have here on the property from that time era, which was, you know, like the early 1700s or something like that. And what it suggests to me is there was lots of colonization going on there, and at one point some people may have just looked at Oak Island and said, and it might have been the French, and said, hey, let's just build a fort here. Let's build a little, you know, colony commune thing here for whatever our purposes are in occupying this. And that's going to involve a lot of structures like water structures and walls and roads and things of that nature. And at some point, they just decide, you know what, we don't want to finish this place. We're not going to bother to build it because we run out of budget. The Queen of Spain, or sorry, the Queen of France changed her mind, whatever it was. And they just abandoned it. And you have what are on the surface seem like very disjoint, mysterious structures. And you're trying to look at them through the lens of treasure, they seem weird. But when you just look at it through a lens of, yeah, they were just going to build another fort there or something, they seem, yeah, that makes sense that they would build a lot of that stuff. So that's the what I think it might end up being the most realistic reason for why they're finding all this old weird stuff there. And it's buttressed by why do you need a super heavy road to move treasure in? You're just burying it, right? You're burying the stupid treasure. You don't need, it's a one-time event, and hopefully only one other time will you go back to retrieve it. So why build a road that, that is so much more energy? I mean, you're talking, you'd have to spend a significant amount of the treasure just to build the stupid road. And it's not because, you know, gold is so heavy. You just, you don't have to, you know, move all the gold at once. You move it in little bags, you know, so that you can get it through off the ship to wherever you're going to bury it. The exception would be is that you have something like, oh, I don't know, an Ark of the Covenant made out of solid gold, right? You're not going to break that into pieces because it's the freaking Ark of the Covenant and you have to move it at one piece. And if that is made out of something like solid gold, that is that would sink right into the swamp. So you have to, you have to create something to haul it off on. I think that's highly unlikely, unfortunately, because even if it was the Ark and maybe one or two other artifacts like that, there are other ways to move a one-time thing like that, you know, like using heavy trees and planks and stuff like that, rather than building this incredible road. So while I hope, you know, that it's the latter where, you know, they're moving crazy golden arcs and who knows what else in there, and they just needed a road to support that kind of weight, I don't think it's as likely as the, you know, at some point people were going to build a fort on there and they changed their minds.
Okay. I'm with you on all of that, but we have some buts. One, there's no record of any kind of official fort happening here, and this was at a time when records were being kept. If it's the 18th century, if it's earlier than that, that would be kind of crazy. And if it's way earlier than that, that's a completely different discussion. Second of all, if you're going to leave your fort, you, generally speaking, forts get abandoned. They don't get covered up and hidden.
So I think those are superb points, and you may well be right. I have one counterpoint to them, which is if you're the French and you're doing something clandestine, like you're trying to take over some land that might not be yours for the taking, you might do it in a clandestine fashion where you're doing it little by little. And then if you change your mind, you might want to bury it so that there's no evidence that you were doing something you weren't supposed to. Right, like
it's a major effort. Major effort to build.
I agree. I don't know what's likely. You know, that's part of the loss. Yeah, I hear you. I'm not saying what you're saying is implausible. I'm just saying that's a potential counter to it. And that's what makes what makes this so interesting. This is like for people that have like my friend Walt, who have very low tolerance for things not moving along, this is not a show for them, because this is like watching paint dry is easier than watching this show, because so little new information is added each episode. But the cool part of the show is it's a real time for real mystery that you get to help work on solving. And there was that one lady that they got that had some cool new theories that they tried, you know, and she was just some person that got interested in this and sent her theories, and they liked it. And they found some interesting stuff, right? With the anchor stones from that map, that they found. So that's the cool part of this show. But yeah, the level of progress per show is glacial,
but speeding up radically. Episodes or seasons 3 and 4 were extra glacial. Season 5, I think, was the most glacial. And I think in season 6, things started picking up when they started digging underneath Smith's Cove. And season 7 and season 8 to me have both been rather interesting.
While I agree with everything you said, I want to put a little context to it. That is a statement of high relativism. So if you were going from a you know, a disclosure rate of 0.00000000001%, and you increase things by 1,000%, it's still 0.00000001%.
No, that is. That is fair. And I also have a bias here. I've been interested in this story since I read the same Reader's Digest story that the Lagina brothers read in the 60s. I read it in the 70s. So I do have a bias of built-in interest to the whole thing.
I think it's super fascinating. Regardless of what it is, kudos to them for having the wherewithal do what a lot of people would love to do. It'd be treasure hunters for your job. It's awesome. Good for
by that. I have, by the way, something that might require a road involved in a fort, and that would be cannons.
Mm-hmm.
You might, yeah, well, I know. Might well build, yeah, a road to move cannons and shot back and forth.
But I think that supports my fort. I know. Yeah,
it does.
Yeah, it does. So, I hope my theory is wrong, but I'm rooting them for finding some good golden loot.
Or something, anything. I mean, because the reality is that even if something magnificent was buried there and was never recovered, at this point, all of the search efforts may have just utterly destroyed it.
Now, right. Works of Shakespeare have been blended into mud long ago at this point.
Yeah. Long ago, if it's something like that. Now, if it's gold, I mean, of course, the gold itself wouldn't be destroyed, but, you know, it could be broken apart. The show always like talks about how they're looking for a treasure. And that sort of, like, I'm talking about the narrator, who is the same narrator that does Ancient Aliens, so, you know,
which is awesome.
Take that with a grain of salt. The supposition of that framing is that there is a treasure to be found, but there is no documentation whatsoever of a treasure other than the weird bits that have been found, like some gold actually has been found. Right? Back in the one of the searchers drilled down and supposedly there was traces of gold that came up with the drill bit. We have seen what looked like gold when they were diving.
Yeah, in the other underwater cavern, I guess. Space that they drilled into. Yeah.
But at the same time, when they actually sent someone down again a second time in a much more thorough search effort, they didn't find anything. So, you know, take that with a grain of salt too. But there is no guarantee that there is actually anything to be found. There's no guarantee that if there is anything to be found, it hasn't been totally wrecked. And lastly, they constantly mention a supposed, what's the word?
Curse.
A curse. The seven people have to die before they're going to find it. But they've never once sourced that curse. I've never heard of this curse. The only place I've ever heard of this curse is when it's mentioned on the show by the narrator, not by the people who were looking, and they've never sourced it. And that
clickbait here and there just for marketing purposes.
Yes.
Is the suspicion there. But anyway, I think we're up to date on this, but I agree this year compared to the glacial paces of previous years has been really interesting. I'm rooting for them. The good news is they seem to have gotten enough money to drill a lot more, and it's weird. They're kind of, They're really not putting an emphasis on that, which they did in prior years, which makes me hopeful that there's something good coming at the end of the season. And they've constantly been hitting along tunnels that they've been looking for with a high degree of success. So knock wood, hopefully that means they'll find something interesting.
Indeed.
I suspect it will be a cliffhanger for the season then.
Because otherwise, if they had found something, we would have been getting, and it's all leading up to, you know, an incredible find or something to that effect.
Right.
I don't think they're going to artificially keep us from seeing anything that they find, because they wouldn't be able to keep that secret, and then it's spoiled.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, that aside, let me now tell you about my second sponsor, which is Molecule. Now, if you've been listening to my show for any length of time, you know that I've been a Molecule customer and a Molecule user for years. I got my first one in May, might have been June, early June, almost 3 years ago, and I've been very, very happy about them. I got them because I was concerned about wildfires in California, and I was concerned about the air quality. Whenever we get fires, I'm here in Silicon Valley, and the soot, the smoke, all that stuff gets funneled into the valley, and it can sometimes sit here for a while, and air becomes very dangerous. And I was super excited about Molecule. But in addition to just keeping my air clean, the thing about Molecule is the company's Pico technology. It's P-E-C-O. And what it does, that stands for photoelectrochemical oxidation. And it is designed to destroy harmful pollutants in the air like viruses, bacteria, mold, and chemicals instead of just collecting them on filters. Molecule air purifiers destroy the widest range of pollutants compared to traditional air purifiers, including, like I said, viruses, bacteria, mold, allergens, and chemicals. Molecule air, that's one of their products, that's designed for large rooms, up to 600 square feet. Molecule air mini is designed for small rooms, up to 250 square feet. Molecule air mini plus helps protect small rooms with a particle sensor and auto protect mode, which adjusts for fan speed based on the sensor. And then there's Molecule Air Pro. It's designed for extra large rooms up to 1,000 square feet. And check this out, Molecule Air Pro RX received 510K Class 2 medical device clearance for medical purposes to destroy bacteria and viruses in the air. And Molecule's technology has been verified with rigorous testing in independent third-party labs. But most importantly, from my perspective, I love my molecules. I love having them in my home. I love having nice, clean, fresh air, even when it gets really horrible outside. And I'm hoping that this year, maybe we've had a lot of rain, kind of hoping that maybe this won't be quite as fiery a fire season. But boy, you never know what's coming up. And I'm glad that I've got my molecules here in my house. Now, here is the thing, because you are listening to ACM, you can save up to $120 on an air purifier. All you have to do is visit molecule.com. That's M-O-L-E-K-U-L-E.com. And when you go to checkout, enter ACM. And if you do that, you can save up to $120 on an air purifier. So absolutely and positively check them out. Been a happy customer. I paid for my molecules. I've been a happy customer for years now. And I'm very, very happy that they sponsored this week's episode of ACM. All right, John, we have another little interesting thing. I was kind of surprised you wanted to talk about this. And I can't, and we haven't chatted about it at all, so I have no idea what your angle is. But you wanted to talk about the fact that Justin Long is a turncoat and is no longer a Mac, but is now like a PC or something.
Yeah. What do you think about those ads and that whole thing?
Well, I haven't seen them. I haven't actually seen them. I know the story. The story is that he's advertising for Intel, if I remember
correctly. For Intel, correct.
Yeah. And basically saying that, you know, hey, you know, that was the I'm a Mac, that was a character, I'm really a person, and yay Windows or something.
Yeah, so they start off with alluding to that, which is kind of like a 10-year-old ad, which is weird, you know, like I'm not sure anyone remembers or cares outside of, you know, the tech people in the world. But I guess you haven't seen him, but they're pretty straightforward. And then he really regurgitates what a lot of the other PC ads have been showing, right? Was like, oh, you can't have a touchscreen on a Mac, right? Okay, thanks for that, you know, flash thing. Or now Macs are boring because they're gray. Okay, so your purple device with you know, spinner wheels on it and stuff, that's awesome, high design. I'm really, really sad I can't get that, thanks. It's kind of like rehashed weak sauce arguments on that. They make fun of the touch bar a bit, which frankly I think is deserved, but nobody really cares, right? You're buying a Mac because it's a freaking Mac. Of course they don't touch the performance issues, right? Because it would be over. I guess I don't care that they're doing it, whatever, but it just, I don't know, it smacks desperate. Like
on
like,
Intel's really, part, I agree.
Yeah.
Because Intel is putting Apple in the driver's seat.
Yeah, it just seems like a bad chess move. Like, what you want to do is ignore this as long as possible so that it's not in the public's conscious, right? Like, right. Why would you, where you're driving attention to, oh man, these Macs with their chip have new chips, and You know what I mean? Like you're just drawing attention to something you don't want to draw attention to until they can get their fabrication back up to speed, or really just outsource their fabrication to Taiwan people. Semiconductor, yeah. like everybody else does. So whatever their solution is to being, you know, horribly behind, I think that they're still having trouble even getting down to 10 nanometers, and most of their production is still 14 nanometers in a world where Apple has been shipping 5 nanometers for like a year and will be going down to 3 freaking nanometers next year, which is insane. It's insane. So I just don't get the thinking there. And if anything, also by implication, they're making, you know, AMD seem like a better bet too, because the AMD chips just are that better. It's a weird thing to draw attention to. It sounds very defensive. It reminds me of Facebook. Like when Apple says we're going to have this privacy software that doesn't let Facebook track you as much, and Facebook loses its mind in this public crusade saying it's the end of times, and like it's almost like telling shareholders leave, run away, right? Like bad things are going to happen, rather than saying whatever, we'll deal with this when it comes, which is the reality of it, is they'll figure out a way to, you know, to deal with it. So they're making it a bigger issue than it should be. It just seems horrible advice on the marketing side. I don't get it.
I agree with that. And let's sort of take a step up a little bit and look at the bigger picture. There is an old rule of thumb that by no means everyone follows, that you don't mention your competition when you're advertising.
Right.
Right. And of course, Apple mentioned PCs in this very ad campaign that we're talking about, the I'm a Mac campaign. But when Apple did that, they were not putting PCs in the driver's seat. They successfully compared their product to the competition without making their competition the competition to beat.
And right, because they didn't say, Acer or whatever, right?
Or Windows.
Right.
Right? It's just, you know, generic PC. The PC was always bumbling. You're in no way putting the PC in the driver's seat, putting PC as the thing to beat. But it seems like whenever Microsoft mentions a Mac, that Microsoft manages to make the Mac look like the device to beat. And, yeah, and it feels weird. Like Intel is doing the exact same thing with this campaign too. And again, in a weird way, to like, as you said, to, you know, they're surfacing a campaign that really probably the only people that really care about are Mac fans, and right. They're not going to win. They're not going to win converts from the Mac world.
I don't think on the basis of these ads, they're legitimate things that PCs do better. I there's no question about that. And Mac users have generally said those things don't matter that much to me, right? So, but there are things you can win converse with. But this again, I'm not sure is the way. And Apple did mention Windows to some degree at the height of the Vista, you know, debacle. They also mentioned that, I think in one or two of those ads that, you know, Vista was having some trouble to dog pound on.
Yeah, but they still didn't. They didn't put Vista in the driver's seat. They didn't put Microsoft in the driver's seat.
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of a degree vest. It is weird. It does come off to me as very much, just very much promoting the opposite of what they want to achieve on it.
I agree.
And I think if I were Intel, what I want to achieve is, look, just keep quiet. Hopefully in a year or two, we can solve this problem. And the sheer just kind of, momentum of the market will cover this gap versus pay attention to it. So yeah, interesting. Maybe they're right. I don't know. You hope that they had smart people.
They're probably not. Now there's one other element to this, and that's Justin Long himself. And there's an old Adamant line that I've always, and Adamant was channeling other people, but it's money's money, my little honey. Rich man's jokes are always funny. You know, I mean, you know, more power to Justin for being able to get money for the same gig from two different companies.
Right. I think it's also a weird choice because you know, back in the day, he's kind of young, and now he's old.
And right, he was young and cool compared to the very stodgy John Hodgman.
Right,
the brilliant. Awesome. I should say, I should say the brilliantly stodgy John Hodgman.
Right,
he was so good in that role. So Justin doesn't have the same sort of cachet as he did for that kind of like young hip. Kind of look. It is an interesting choice, but to be fair, since the bunny ads, when has Intel's advertising been good?
That's fair.
I mean, the bunny ads were great. I think they did a really good job with those.
But you know what? Back then, they had something. I think they were also effective because they had the added benefit of being true. When everyone was telling Intel, "Oh, you'll never go 500, you know, megahertz or whatever," and year after year, Intel was cranking. They're kind of doing. That was Intel's heyday. When everyone says, "Oh, you looking up with their very erudite academic CISC versus RISC chips," right? And they were pooing on them. And what's his name? Grove buried them, making them the fools that they were as a result, right? He just turned them all into idiot liars by progressing Intel chips way beyond the rest of the industry. Year after year, they were hitting crazy milestones. And it reminds me in some way of really Taiwan Semiconductor, right? Every year, these guys are going down to crazy small. Like, I can't believe the progress they've made in the last like 6 or 7 years. It's insane. So, yeah, back then the ads had the ad benefit of not just being puffery, but of being true.
Yeah.
So that helped, I think, a lot.
Yeah, it is. I everything you said, I completely agree with. So I don't know. We'll see what Intel does. Intel is in trouble, if you ask me. You know, they've got AMD killing them on the performance side. They've got Apple killing them on the performance and power consumption side. And they really just don't seem to be able to get it together.
Yeah. I mean, I think what they should do, assuming Taiwan Semiconductor is willing to help them, and I don't see why not, is they've got to start using them to at least get these reduced fabrication versions of their chips, because the chip there, it's not like their chip designs are bad, it's just they can't fab them. So get that out, use another provider, and use that to give your folks in your fabs some breathing room to do what they need to do, which is completely re-engineer things, obviously. Heck, maybe they learned something from the Taiwan Semiconductor folks in the meantime. But yeah, don't let pride get in the way of doing the right thing here by your customers and for the company in general. Assuming they can do that, they could put in bigger orders than AMD, and all of a sudden AMD is going to have some serious competition.
Yeah. Good times to live. You know, it's it is hard. I'm literally at a loss of words here. It is hard to fathom that today Apple is making the best chips.
Well, yes and no, right? Their designs are awesome, no doubt, and they have year after year like crazy good designers. Probably they might be the best in the business. I personally believe they're the best in the business and by far. But, you know, don't downplay the role that Taiwan Semiconductor has in this. True. It's not like Apple has made a fab that's producing 5-nanometer chips. It's Taiwan Semiconductor making that magic happen.
Yeah, but Apple's money has also helped TSMC do that.
Yes, it's what's that old line? It's such a true line. You know, money can't buy you happiness, but it certainly can make a lot of things easier.
Can make a lot of things easier. And Apple has become expert in investing in its supply chain in ways that end up giving Apple a competitive advantage. And that's like one of the untold, unsung stories of and I know you're going to love this line of Tim Cook's successful run at the helm of this company.
Tim Cook is incompetent. He needs to be kicked out. He doesn't know business 101. This is a person that doesn't know diversification. Where's all the manufacturing for Apple for phones?
Look at all the
in
things
one, that, in that, one we're, communist we're
talking,
basket.
We're talking you about could, something that happened.
John, you can do many things right, but he doesn't have business 101 straight. He didn't diversify his business.
This entire segment of the show is about something that happened under his watch.
Yes. Look, he gets a lot of kudos for a lot of things right. That he doesn't do business 101 is inexcusable. Inexcusable. And it could have been much. It could be much worse. At any random time, it could get much worse. COVID showed that, and there are worse things than COVID that would stop production. You have to diversify your products chain. You do. It's business 101. Anyway, Tim Cook gets credit for that, I guess. But you know who else benefits from that? AMD. AMD has 5-nanometer chips and 7-nanometer chips because why? Because they use Taiwan Semiconductor. So Apple has enabled its competitors to also be better by not doing it themselves.
That is a good argument. That is a good argument. Okay, look, hold on. I knew it was unfair to poke you with that.
As we you get what you deserve.
I did. I completely got what I deserve. Listen, I want to, first of all, John, thank you very much.
Thank you
for being here this week, man. I really appreciate it. And it was a very, very fun conversation. And I feel like, anyway, very fun conversation. Second of all, I want to thank LinkedIn Jobs. And remember, when your business is ready to make that next hire, find the right person with LinkedIn Jobs. And now you can get your first post of a job for free. All you have to do is visit linkedin.com/ACM. Again, that's linkedin.com/ACM. And while I'm mentioning it, I want to thank Molecule for sponsoring us. And you can save up to $120 on an air purifier by visiting molecule.com. That's MOLECULE.com. And at checkout, enter ACM. Again, John, thank you very much, man. Let's see. Hold on. I'm not even doing this right. Let's do this. And now I'll thank you again. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to the next time you're on the show.
Always a pleasure, man. I enjoyed it too.